Hey, welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Sarah.
And I'm Devin.
And we're back on a Monday.
It is a Monday. I slept in this morning, which never ever happens.
It was so weird. I got here. So Devin leaves her door unlocked.
Yeah.
And so I walk in. I walk through the living room and the kitchen, and then I go outside because Devin's little office is actually like a separate, like semi-detached.
Right, it's off the garage.
Off the garage. So then I walk through to open the door. So if Devin's not in the main house, she's usually like waiting for me in her office, and she wasn't there. And I was like, holy shit, what just happened? Are we doing a podcast today?
Yeah.
Devin's like, I've had a rough weekend.
I literally slept until 9, which never happens. And so I was literally in the bathroom, like, brushing my teeth, and, like, I was like, oh, crap, she's probably here, and, like, just wandered out,
and
like,
I was.
Dazedly, so.
Yes, we needed some time to reboot our system.
Yeah, exactly.
Devin needed some coffee. I feel like so much stuff happens. Like, we can't update our outlines quick enough.
We can't.
And we saw news this morning that we're going to probably delve into more deeply in another podcast.
Right.
Because there's just too much else to cover today. But
right.
We wanted to address it really quick. Apparently, the DCCC chairman came out and said that there's no litmus test on abortion and that they would still fund anti-abortion candidates, anti-reproductive choice candidates, and that's some bullshit.
That is some bullshit.
So we're a little heated at Hellbent HQ this morning.
We are. Lauren Duca said it nicely. I'm paraphrasing a little bit here, but basically, this is a betrayal to every Democratic woman.
Yeah.
I mean, women's bodies cannot be up for debate. They can't be on the line.
It's bananas that this shit is still apparently negotiable.
Right.
And it's like, what do Democrats stand for?
Exactly. Again, Sarah and I were talking about this before the show. I am all for, you know, there's a gradient. You're going to have different candidates for different districts, and that's fine. You
right.
know, Stacey Abrams was actually talking about that, how you need to fit the candidate to the district.
Sure.
And I realized that not all districts you're going to come out swinging saying, I'm pro-abortion.
Pro-choice.
Pro-choice.
Yeah.
You're not pro-abortion. But
you can be pro-abortion.
Right.
As
but,
well.
Like, pro-choice.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that you need to openly have a litmus test and say that that's okay.
Right.
You know?
Or that you're going to fund anti-abortion candidates.
Right.
And someone from NARAL pointed out that there's a small minority of voters who vote solely on anti-choice platforms.
Right.
And those people are not going to vote for Democrats anyway.
Right.
So like Devin said, there might be a gradient
mm-hmm.
in certain districts, certain areas. Maybe you're not gung-ho. You're not discussing certain things. You're not like coming out in front of being, you know, pro-choice.
Right.
Or whatever. There's a whole host of factors. And there's an understanding that there, you know, you have to be practical in
right.
certain instances. Like, but for party leaders to be saying this,
not
it's
okay.
bullshit. And it's following in line with other party leaders who have said similar things and who are also saying that their economic agenda is not going to include social issues. And like Stacey Abrams said in our podcast last week, social issues are economic issues. So get that through your fucking head, Democratic men on the left.
Get it tattooed on your forehead.
I'm going to get it tattooed on
right.
my fucking forehead.
Yeah, so like, when you look at me, it's like, social issues are economic issues.
And like, besides that, I'm like, this is a whole other thing, but I'm also resentful of the fact that we have to put a dollar amount on it.
Yes.
Like, we shouldn't have to.
But it
does. It very heavily intersects. So anyway, Devin and I wanted to briefly address that. We have a really packed show.
Right.
We'll probably get to it in our next show to sort of fully download it.
Yeah,
I'm sure there will be reactions and there will be perspectives we want to share.
Also, the show is full as fuck.
Yeah.
So let's go over.
A tight 10 pages.
So let's go over what we're going to talk about. So first of all, we're going to start with listener feedback and general updates like we always do. The next block is sort of a perma block now. And we called it, holy shit, healthcare.
We have so many rotating perma blocks. It kind of goes against the definition of permanent. Don't tell anyone.
Block three, we're actually going to talk about the bananas Trump police rally that he did in Suffolk County.
We're gonna delve through a few different issues there.
Yeah, and then block four, we have our gratitude check, as always. And then we also were keeping the listener gratitude check, which
is
really great.
We have one long listener gratitude check that
right.
we really love.
And then it is Monday, so kick off the week with the Donald Trump dishonor and Dick Watery. And then finally, we'll have some action items, so some things that you can do after you listen to the show. Okay, Sarah, so let's jump in with some listener feedback. We got some really great feedback about our interview with Stacey Abrams.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was so much fun to do.
It was so much fun.
And it, you know, I think we've gotten to talk to a lot of awesome people, almost exclusively women.
Yeah.
And we always get great feedback about it because, I mean, the people we talk to are so amazing and brilliant. Mm-hmm. But I think that this interview was the most sort of positively received, both in volume and sentiment.
Like, yes.
People love them some Stacey Abrams.
Oh, yeah. I love me some Stacey Abrams.
I know. Like, how do we get in a group text with her?
Seriously.
That's, like, the next level, I
think. Yes.
But we have to take it slow.
Right.
We can't, like, jump at that, like, too soon.
Right.
Like, we gotta play the long game.
But I'm with you on that. Like, a group text where we just, like, talk about brunch.
Yeah.
Would be awesome.
Star Trek, politics.
Takes brunch.
Brunch, all the things.
Yes.
So, yeah, at What Is Liz, she tweeted us and said, quote, "Stacey Abrams motivates me. We can run for office, write romance novels, and champion social causes. We can do all the things."
Yeah, we fucking can.
Yes, we fucking can.
So good.
And then Lisa said, "Love this interview. Listened to it twice to be sure I didn't miss anything. She is fantastic, and Star Trek geek out was adorbs." And I will say that, like, you friends don't even know how fucking adorable that bonding sesh between Representative Abrams and Devin was, like, in real time. It was so cute. I was, like coming at the seams.
Yeah.
It was, like, the most adorable thing.
It was pretty great.
Yeah.
And then Amy said...
Oh, wait, but you missed...
Oh, I missed!
You missed the fact that Representative Abrams
herself
also tweeted us and said, quote, "I had the best time with Sarah Lerner and Devin Handy. Politics, Resistance, Star Trek, Voyager, and Harry Potter. A well-rounded discussion."
We really talked
about all the things. We can do all the things.
We can do all the things.
Women are great multitaskers.
It's really true.
Women are so, like, dynamic.
We talked about very serious, like, political issues and also Captain Janeway.
Living Devin's best life.
Or just living my best life. I don't know.
Well, I'm living Devin's best life.
Right.
With her.
I literally said it the other day on the podcast, but, like, this is great.
Yeah, this is your sweet spot. And then Amy said, quote, "In addition to the content, my fave thing about the pod is the way Devin and Sarah's friendship plays, hearing them support and validate each other."
I know.
We're making ugly faces.
We are.
Right now because we're like, oh. Because, like, female friendships are, like, the fucking best.
They really are. They're the fucking best. And, you know, especially post-election, like, and I was actually just telling, I was talking to someone about Sarah.
Aww.
Yeah, but I was saying that what's really happened since we started doing this and, like, since we've become closer friends, like, you've really changed the way I view my support network.
Yeah.
I'm like, you know, the women in my life can be, like, supportive and cool and, mm-hmm. and, you know, you don't have to, like, just settle for, you know, like, a shitty support network.
Right.
Like, you can
totally
seek out people who, like, support you.
Truly support you. And I've just definitely noticed, especially post-election, like, I've really leaned on my female friendships.
Yeah, me too.
And I'm just, like, so grateful for all, like, the amazing women in my life.
Yeah,
so
too.
I love female friendships.
No, me too. Okay, so... Correction from Sarah Lerner, our Sarah, who
Devin
literally
never believes me.
I know. Who literally
we're
like
working on it.
Who literally slacked me right after the episode and was like, "Look, bitch."
I didn't say that. It was much more passive aggressive.
It was.
I put it in our listener feedback Slack channel.
She did.
But I was also like, I need to remember this.
Yeah. So I had mentioned that JFK had triggered a decline in the sales of men's hats because legend goes that he started the trend by not wearing a hat to the 1961 election or inauguration. And Snopes, our friend Snopes, has declared this legendary tale false. Apparently,
but it was quite an urban legend.
It was.
A lot of people believed it.
Yes.
I will say that, like, a lot of people have repeated this to the point where it seems like truth.
It does seem like truth.
Which they addressed in their article.
It even sounds like it could be a thing.
It totally does.
So, but JFK did, in fact, wear a hat to his inauguration. And I would just like to say, this is why we donate to keep Snopes live, people.
I know, that was literally in our last action items. That's very relevant.
It's very relevant.
And like Devin said last week, we do not support alternative facts.
Right.
And if we ourselves are mistakenly repeating them, we make sure to correct them.
Exactly. So donate to Snopes. Urban legends.
And then, so a couple updates on our end. The August newsletter is going to come out this week. We're shooting to send on Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
You can sign up at hellbentpodcast.com/newsletter. And then for Patreon people, no bonus podcasts early in the week, but we'll have one by Friday.
Okay.
Okay, Sarah, so let's jump right in to holy shit healthcare.
We're not subtle in our block titles.
Not even a little bit. It's been a week.
It's been like, yeah, it's been 84 fucking years.
And it's been a little bananas.
It's been bananas. So where we left off on Hellbent last Thursday.
Where
so
we last left our heroes.
Yeah. This is how we think of ourselves. Yeah, so we record in the morning. So where we left off, you know, we were talking about what had happened that week and that Republicans were going to hold some sort of vote that night on Thursday night, but we didn't know what it would be and when and how it would look like. And holy shit, did that end up being a dramatic fucking night.
It really was.
I stayed up late and watched it on C-SPAN, and I was like on pins and needles, so I was so fucking nervous.
You know your life is taking a left turn when you're staying up late to watch C-SPAN.
I know, these are our lives. And like, I can't even imagine being on East Coast time.
I know.
Like, I could barely stay up on West Coast time.
Right.
Hashtag this is 30.
Right.
So they ended up bringing the quote-unquote skinny repeal amendment to the floor, with its, like, final version being hastily written that day. Democrats didn't even see the text of it until a few hours before the vote.
Wasn't it, like, 8 pages of nonsense?
I don't even know. But it just shows you how broken this process is and how much, like, Mitch McConnell has, like, broken the Senate.
Oh, 100%. So this skinny repeal would have eliminated the individual and employer mandate and key taxes and defunded Planned Parenthood for a year, which, like, why? Like, just for a year?
Because they funsies? Feel like it.
Yeah. And eliminated key protections of health benefits that were required under the ACA. So basically, it was, from what I've heard, it was like 8 pages. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot to pack into 8 pages of nonsense.
Well, and it, like, essentially the skinny repeal, like we said, is like a partial repeal.
I get it.
That even is kind of a misnomer.
Yeah.
Because that's a lot of key elements.
Exactly.
Of ACA.
It's not so skinny so much as like, there are only a couple things that we're trying to repeal, but they're kind of the central themes here.
Right.
So the CBO actually scored a version on Thursday night and found that 16 million people would lose their health insurance just in 2018 if this quote-unquote skinny repeal passed.
Right.
And premiums would have risen 20% each year over the next decade. So basically, it was a hot fucking mess.
Yeah, and that was the version on Thursday. So we don't know, like, if how closely aligned the version on Friday was.
Right.
But that's just to give you a baseline.
Right.
Right? And, yeah, like Devin said, it was a hot fucking mess. The bill was super unpopular, even among Republicans. But GOP leaders had sort of worked to assure its members that it would never become law, which to me was the weirdest fucking part.
Okay, all right. So I'm gonna do a quick civics lesson for the people in the Senate.
How a bill becomes a law?
Right. And when you vote on something as a lawmaker, it is so that it can become law. It's a process.
That's the intent.
That's the intent.
And that's usually how it works out. So basically, they wanted the Senate to pass it in order to advance the legislation to a third round of negotiations with the House to try to craft a final bill that both chambers could pass. But A, if a bill sucks this much, again, like Devin said, why the fuck would you vote for it?
Like,
you vote for things so that they can become laws.
Exactly.
B, there wasn't any guarantee that the House wouldn't just take that crappy version
right.
and just, like, pass it.
Right.
And just, they wouldn't even try to negotiate.
Oh, and I'm sorry, with Paul fucking Ryan running the show, I don't trust that slimy motherfucker.
Nope. So here's what ended up happening in, like, sort of the wee early hours of East Coast time.
Mm-hmm.
The Senate ended up voting 51-49 with, of all people, John McCain joining Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski as the only 3 Republicans to vote no. Like, it just barely didn't pass.
Yeah. You know, it really made us think about Maggie Hassan, the freshman Democrat from New Hampshire, who barely won her election by about 1,000 votes.
Yeah, there was hundreds of thousands of votes cast.
And she won by about 1,000.
1,000. And it really shows you that every vote matters.
It really does.
And, like, if we had one less Democrat,
right,
like, it could have been a completely different story.
Oh, it totally would have been. And so there were these dramatic videos of that moment with McCain giving the thumbs down. And then McConnell, and this was the best part of the whole process. This was the best part. McConnell just looked like he shit a fucking brick.
Yeah.
Like, he just, his face was just, like,
totally sullen.
Totally sullen.
And then you hear all these Democrats sort of, like, gasping in surprise.
Yeah,
like,
we didn't think we had it.
It was a very dramatic moment. And, you know, Chris Murphy actually wrote a super interesting behind-the-scenes piece on Medium that we'll link to in the show notes. And in it, Murphy describes at one point running into John McCain at midnight. So like right before the vote.
Right.
And McCain says, "Murph." And so this is how Chris Murphy describes it. "Murph," he yells and swats me on the back. "Someday I'll get to tell my grandkids what he said next."
But then he doesn't tell us what he said next.
I'm like, Chris Murphy, what the fuck did John McCain say next?
Right.
Like, I want to know.
Like,
you can't tease us like this.
No, you really can't.
I hope it's something like, "Fuck that motherfucker, Donald Trump."
Yeah, no, me too. I hope it's like really vulgar and that's why he can't print it.
Exactly. I also love this quote from the NPR article that we sourced. It says, quote, "McConnell, who seemed to exhaust every trick in the procedural playbook to get to this point, seemed surprised and undercut by the result."
Yeah.
And yeah, I think that video of Mitch McConnell like crying during his speech on in the Senate, that'll sustain me for a long period of time.
Oh, in my darkest days.
in your darkest hours, you just pull up the YouTube video.
And be like, oh, I'm fine.
Yeah. I actually remember I had really awful cramps the next morning. And I have to say that yelling, "Fuck you, Mitch McConnell," it felt great.
Oh, I'm sure. No, that sounds perfect.
It helped, I will say.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just, like, apply heating pad and then yell, "Fuck you, Mitch McConnell."
The insta solution.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so we touched on this. So McCain joined Murkowski and Collins to ultimately vote down this skinny repeal. But let's talk about, like, who's getting the credit and who deserves to get credit here.
Yeah, there's a lot of, like, sort of complex layers that we want to unpack. So the media really shit their pants over McCain. And, you know, I'll give them this. It was definitely surprising. I was not expecting that.
I mean, the Democrats fucking gasped in chambers because they didn't think they had it.
Apparently Chuck Schumer knew a couple hours before. And, like, Mike Pence was, like, trying to, like, whip up John McCain, but it didn't work.
Got it.
Obviously. But, like, a lot of Democrats didn't know.
Yeah.
And, like, you can hear
right.
the gasping in the chamber.
Yeah. And there was also some, like Schadenfreude poetry here.
Yeah.
Because Trump made those ignorant-ass comments in 2015 about McCain, about how he likes people who, quote, weren't captured.
Yeah. And so part of, like, the petty part of me hopes that factored in.
Oh, I hope so.
On top of, you know, not taking away people's healthcare. Like,
right.
I hope that's the main fucking thing.
Right.
But, like, a petty part of me is, like, I hope that's kind of part of it. Like, he wanted to fuck over Donald Trump.
He's like, I waited. I waited silently.
I took my shot.
I took my shot.
Yeah. But let's also not motherfucking forget that two GOP women didn't waver throughout this entire fucking process.
At all.
And I love the way that Jenny Yang put it on Twitter. She said, quote, "Giving McCain the credit for defeating this repeal when female senators Murkowski and Collins were early no's is every work meeting ever."
So true.
Which is just sums it up perfectly.
It does.
And remember that Collins and Murkowski faced threats of violence from men within their own goddamn party.
Like physical violence.
Physical violence.
Yeah.
Like beating and a duel.
A duel, which is like, what? Something about a snatch and a knot.
In someone's ass.
I have no idea.
We don't, yeah. We discussed it last podcast. And also Murkowski was even intimidated or... they tried to intimidate.
They tried. I was going
to
say.
Try being the operative word. A Trump administration official tried to intimidate Murkowski. So this administration official is the Interior Secretary.
Zinke. Ryan Zinke.
Yeah, I don't know how you correctly pronounce that, but it's Zinke. And he threatened both her and the other senator from Alaska with some sort of retribution to the state because of her no vote. And this turned out to be hilariously short-sighted because apparently Murkowski has power over his department.
Right, because she's the head of the subcommittee for...
She controls appropriations,
that's
basically.
It.
And so she was like, checkmate, bitch.
Yeah. Also, quick civic lessons to the Secretary of the Interior. Maybe check how the power structure works. If you don't know, like, quick Google before trying to come after someone like Lisa Murkowski, who won a fucking write-in campaign.
Yeah, she was like, people spelled my name correctly. And I won.
So everyone calm down.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that, you know, there are people who... You know, there are definitely people who think that giving any of these Republicans credit is bullshit, which... I certainly understand on a few different levels. So first, you know, the activists, especially the disability rights activists from ADAPT, they put their bodies on the line time and again. They got arrested. They did everything they could to save healthcare. And they really, truly are the real MVPs of this fight.
They really are.
They really are.
And Charlotte at Alter had a great piece in Time about how more broadly women in general in the resistance really played a defining role.
Yeah.
And Ezra Levin even pointed out that women are running in divisible groups at a 2-to-1 margin or more.
Yeah, and so Ezra Levin is a co-executive director of the Indivisible Guide. And so, yeah, it really is women sort of leading the charge here, obviously making most of the calls to Congress,
right.
doing all sort of like the quiet essential work behind the scenes.
Right.
And yeah, and arguably activist efforts are what helped the Democratic caucus stand so strong and united in opposition. Like, say what you will about Chuck Schumer and also Nancy Pelosi. Mm-hmm. Lord knows we have our gripes. But they literally whipped their people into shape.
Oh, yeah.
And a big part of it is because of these activist efforts.
Yeah.
And, like, I also never want to fucking hear how Democrats and Republicans are, quote, the same again. Because
right.
even the worst Democrat that you can think of yeah. voted no.
Right. Because I'm sure because Chuck Schumer was like, look, I don't care about your fucking feelings.
Fuck your feelings.
Fuck your feelings. And then there is definitely an argument to be made that voting against people losing their health care is a pretty low fucking bar.
Yeah.
And it's honestly the least that a decent person can do, which...
Agree.
Hard agree. You know, but I will say, I do want to give Murkowski and Collins credit.
Mm-hmm.
They stood up to their party.
Well, and that's the thing, right?
You know?
That's the thing. Like, all the sort of aforementioned points are really valid.
They really are.
But the thing is, you know, that we'll say is that we live in quite a partisan and divided time.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, like you said, Republicans bucking their party, especially women who
mm-hmm.
received fucking, like, threats of violence.
Right.
To do so and to vote with the Democrats is sadly pretty remarkable.
It is. And it's all, but you know what? I wouldn't even say sadly remarkable. Like, I would say, you know, they both said publicly that they did not want to take healthcare away from their constituents.
Yeah.
So it wasn't just like there's some big fuck you to the party. They were like, we don't believe in this.
Yeah, they did it in the interest of their constituents.
Exactly.
For sure. And, you know, we've talked about this before on the podcast as well, but Republicans especially
yeah.
fall on the fucking line. And, you know, they'll vote for, like, the shittiest things because
mm-hmm.
it's what their team does,
right.
quote unquote.
Right.
And so, you know, the fact that these three Republicans, especially the two women, helped kill this bill, that was a shock, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think, like you said, it's worth pointing out that two of the three senators who voted no were women. So there are 5 total Republican female senators.
Mm-hmm.
2 out of the 5 of them voted no.
Right.
And only 1 out of 47 Republican male senators
right.
voted no. So
right.
that's worth pointing out. And it's also in line with a larger pattern that female representatives are more willing to not only cross the aisle and collaborate with colleagues on both sides, but they also tend to get more shit done once in office.
It's true. It is very true. And with Congress at only 19% women, it really shows how important gender parity is.
It really does.
And why representation matters. I would also like to point out, just really fast, I'll keep harping on this, Collins and Murkowski also were the only two Republicans who voted no on Betsy DeVos.
Yes.
Which did a lot for me.
Yeah.
And it, like, for them in my eyes.
Although, didn't someone point out, I have to fact check this, that Collins voted yes on proceeding with a nomination, and that was sort of like a tie break. I don't know.
I have to
double check that. So, I mean, there's some complications
right.
there. But yeah, they have shown a willingness to sort of buck their party.
Uh-huh. Especially when it's in the interest of their constituents, which is why we fucking elect people.
And in the interest of the American
people in general.
In terms of Betsy DeVos.
Right.
Obviously, I would much rather see women Democrats get elected.
Of course.
But I think we also should, you know, value having women on the Republican side too. Like, we don't want to just see 52 Republican male senators.
Right.
That's how many Republicans are in the Senate.
Right. And I think that it's good to have people with diversity of thought. Like, just be, you know, you can be a Republican and not be a shitty person. I know it doesn't seem like it right now.
Yeah, it really doesn't.
But this is like,
in an ideal world.
Yeah.
That's how it would work.
Exactly.
We don't live in an ideal world.
Of course not.
Right now. But yeah, I think that's a good point. Okay, so what happens from here? That
right.
We're going to sort of cover these next steps. So immediately after the vote, Richard Burr said, quote, there is no next step. So that's pretty pretty definitive. And then Mitch McConnell followed with, quote, it's time to move on. So they were definitely shooketh.
Yeah.
they were shaking in their boots.
A little bit, yeah. And then... But then Politico reported this weekend that Republicans are actually considering a new repeal effort, with Lindsey Graham leading the charge. You know, but the GOP would have to take another really painful procedural vote to open debate. And McCain will be in Arizona receiving treatment until the end of August recess.
Yeah.
So if they do want to move forward,
it would probably have to be in September at the earliest.
Right. After the August recess.
And, you know, I think it's sort of an important thing to keep in mind. Like, the fact that they still control all 3 branches of government. moment, we can't take for granted that this healthcare debate is done. It certainly isn't.
It's not. Yeah. They're going to keep trying, but
and definitely with Trump sort of pressuring them.
Right.
Like, so we have to sort of be alert, I think.
Right. But I do think there's not going to be any real movement, just in my opinion, until September.
Yeah. That's what it seems like.
That's what it feels like.
Again.
I don't know.
We don't know.
I can't tell the future, but...
Meanwhile, while this is happening, Trump has just threatened to let Obamacare fail. Specifically, he said he wants to, quote, let Obamacare implode as a way to force Democrats to negotiate a deal over replacing the ACA. So there's a lot of sort of like complicated issues here. But the TLDR is that the administration doesn't have the ability to cause ACA to collapse in and of itself, but they can cause some amount of chaos in certain parts of the healthcare system, like the cost-sharing...
subsidies?
The CSRs.
CSRs.
Yeah. And Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price says that Trump won't do that, but then Kellyanne Conway said that Trump will decide this week on it, like it's a fucking game show or something. Like,
this is not a game show. This is people's lives.
This is what happens when we fucking elect the fucking host of the goddamn... Apprentice.
Right. Well, this just feels like all this kind of gamification really feels like the what happened right before the Hunger Games.
Ugh.
You know, that sort of like run up to the Hunger Games.
Oh my God.
I know that sounds really dark and disgusting, but I mean
we kind of live in a dystopic
universe. Yeah, a little bit. With the gamification of people's lives and politics and
it's all to satisfy one man's ego.
Right.
That's really what this is about.
Absolutely.
And he so happens to have the most powerful position, not only in America, but arguably the world.
Right.
So that's cool.
That's
really not.
Well done us. And then of course, our bestie Bernard is already talking about introducing a single payer plan, which, okay.
Okay, so here's the thing. Me personally, I'm all for universal coverage, but I do have a few beefs with this right now.
Right.
So first off, how the fuck do we even pass this while Republicans control all three branches?
We don't.
That's always been my biggest beef with Bernie, is like he never quite answers the how adequately. How the fuck do we do this?
Right. Well, because it's not about like the plan. It's about the message.
Well, the mechanism.
Right.
Like, we have to pass it through the House and the Senate, and we have to count on the fact that Donald Trump's going
to
sign it?
Right, and if he doesn't, then we have to throw it to a veto vote? Like, no, that's not a thing. But like I said, for Bernard, it's not about the mechanism. It's not about actually getting it done. It's about the messaging.
Right.
Him going out there and saying, healthcare for all, which is a really beautiful thing to say. It's just not reality.
Right now.
Right now, at least, yeah.
And, like, second of all, I'm also worried that pushing aggressively for this right now, my question is, will it actually achieve the opposite effect? Will it galvanize Republicans to then pass a shitty repeal of ACA?
I think it
will. That's my biggest question.
Yeah, I think it absolutely will.
I'm worried about. And third of all, you know, single payer is not the only avenue toward universal health coverage. That's one of the things that really grinds my gears.
Right.
I'm still, you know, I'm not an expert on healthcare. There's a lot of complex issues around it. But I do know that there are many ways to achieve universal healthcare that doesn't have to be a single payer. And actually, a lot of the European countries that Bernie Sanders points to as models aren't actually pure single payer.
Right.
So just put a pin in that.
Yeah. And then lastly, you know, the problem with a single payer sort of message is that with the Hyde Amendment still in place, a single payer would actually put abortion coverage in a tenuous position. Any discussion of single payer needs to be coupled with how we're going to repeal the Hyde Amendment as well.
And this like marries with what we talked about at the top of the show.
Right.
How Democrats are like, abortion, not a litmus test.
I'm right.
Like, oh,
women's,
that's cool.
Women's health, it doesn't
women's
matter.
Women's bodies.
Women's bodies. As long as we're getting what we want, women's bodies can fall by the wayside.
And that's the thing. You know, Ezra Klein wrote in 2014 on the heels of Hobby Lobby, quote, a Republican-led government could decide that taxpayer dollars shouldn't be going to cover contraception at all. And then a single-payer system means no one's insurance covers contraception. And so that's definitely, I think, a larger fear with single-payer than not a lot of people talk about, is that if Republicans control this process, in what ways will they cut certain programs and or subvert the system in order to suit their agenda?
Right. So
that's the scary thing.
Exactly. Because when you centralize power like that, it becomes very easy to manipulate.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not saying that I'm against single payer, though I do think that there are better systems out there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also not an expert in healthcare, but I do know that this sort of messaging sounds really nice, but in practice, I don't think it's really what we want.
Well, there's just a lot of questions, right. I think, that still need to be answered. Right. I'm not necessarily against single payer. I just have some issues. And right. I feel like there's a lot of topics like we talked about, the Hyde Amendment, abortion, that haven't been adequately addressed.
Right.
And when we have men on the Democratic side who are clearly very willing to throw reproductive justice under the bus, that makes me nervous.
Right.
We talked about how Congress is only 19% women.
Right.
If it's if a single payer system is Republican controlled and it's, you know, 80% of men,
right,
who are essentially deciding what to do, I'm like, I don't trust that.
I don't. Well, and then also, now, people talk about getting distracted by topics all the time. Like, don't get distracted by Russia, blah, blah, blah.
My least favorite thing.
I hate when people say that. But what I will say is, right now, single payer feels like a red herring.
Mm-hmm.
Republicans control all three branches of government. So for Bernie to come out and talk about single payer and get people talking about it is sort of like, it's not going to happen. And if you want to talk about healthcare, let's talk about what's going on right now with healthcare.
Improving the ACA.
Exactly. Because that's what we have.
And that's the thing I think that frustrates me, is I feel like this is a way to sort of even drive even more of a wedge.
Right.
On the left, it's like, oh, Democrats aren't going to get behind single payer. Single payer is the only way to achieve all the things we want. That's not necessarily true.
Right.
There's so many different avenues we can take to get to universal health coverage, which I am all for.
Right.
I just, again, the how. There's
exactly.
A lot of questions I have that have not been answered.
Exactly. And so I guess that's why I say single payer feels like a red herring, because we're not talking about it in a larger, like, broader context, like how and when.
Or like a process to get there.
Exactly. We're talking about it as a messaging tool, which really bothers me.
And shout out to one of our listeners, Hannah, who runs Caring for Us, a healthcare indivisible group. She's a great resource on these issues, and I was sort of conferring with her about this last night because she is quite the expert. So shout out to Hannah for helping us here. Okay, Devin, so let's move on to talking about that Trump police rally that happened in Suffolk County.
Yeah. So basically, Trump was at this rally on Long Island, and Trump told the police that they shouldn't worry about being violent.
Ugh.
Yes. So his speech centered around, like, law and order, and specifically the MS-13 gang, whose numbers have grown in Long Island in recent years. He said, quote, "They kidnap, they extort, they rape, and they rob. They stomp on their victims. They beat them with clubs. They slash them with machetes.
Jesus.
And they stab them with knives. They have transformed peaceful parks and beautiful, quiet neighborhoods into bloodstained killing fields. They're animals." Which,
I know. I'm just, I shouldn't be speechless, because this is so in line
with
his rhetoric.
Yeah.
This isn't new. We've talked about this last week in terms of the Boy Scout rally.
Right.
And then he went into an anti-immigrant tear at a later rally in Ohio. This is very in line with who he is. It's just, sometimes it just takes my breath away that he's president still.
Right.
Like, it's still a shock to my system.
Like he said, they slash him with machetes at an official presidential rally.
Yeah.
In Long Island. In reality.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't get over that.
Yeah, and, you know, as Prachi Gupta of Jezebel noted, quote, "His speech, of course, does not mention the fact that the gang formed in Los Angeles as a result of the systemic disenfranchisement of Salvadorans fleeing civil war in the 80s and flawed U.S. immigration and deportation policies in the 90s. It also glosses over the fact that scores of undocumented immigrants from Central America resettle in America to flee the very gang violence and unrest that Trump describes."
Yeah, and, you know, experts actually say that this sort of inflammatory rhetoric that Trump is employing only makes gangs stronger.
Yeah.
So Zeke Johnson of Amnesty International said, quote, "Far from being the root of violence, many people seeking asylum at the southern border are trying to escape the very gangs that President Trump spoke of today. Everybody wants to live free from fear, but that can't be done when our leaders vilify our families, neighbors, and friends as criminals based solely on where they're from. Today's speech leaves everyone at risk."
Yeah. And, I mean, the crackdown on, you know, undocumented immigrants means that victims don't feel safe reporting crimes to police for fear of deportation, which only adds to the problem. And this is something we've talked about before. Like,
yes.
In L.A., you know, for example, I know that reports of sexual assault are down by huge percentages.
Right.
And it's in large part, as a result of who this president is, who the what the administration does. Mm-hmm. Again, you know, Obama was not perfect either. He was known as the deporter in chief for a reason. But like, you know, Devin talked about, this sort of inflammatory rhetoric only plays in to things to make everyone unsafe.
Exactly.
And, you know, even one MS-13 gang member told CNN that, quote, they, so the MS-13, feel like they can do whatever they want because Trump himself has made everybody fear.
Yeah. So basically, you know,
it's bigoted and it doesn't even help.
Right. It actually hurts.
Yeah. It actually, no one is winning here.
Right. No one wants this. So here's the quote that really got people talking and what sort of shocked me. I mean, I can't say shocked me the most, but
yeah,
you know, so he
said, because
this is who he is.
We've known this.
Right. But he said, quote, when you guys put somebody in the car and you're protecting their head, you know, the way you put their hand over. So he was kind of mimicking the action of putting a hand on the head of a suspect to put them in the car. He says, like, don't hit their head. And they just killed somebody. Don't hit their head. I said, you can take the hand away. Okay. He said, please don't be so nice. And his assertion that, quote, thugs being thrown in the back of a paddy wagon, which one of my favorite tweets was from Angry Black Lady, at Angry Black Lady. Mm. She, quote, tweeted this and said, thugs being thrown in the back of a paddy wagon? Are we in 1800s Ireland?
Also, like, every fucking one of you in the Trump administration is a criminal.
Absolutely.
I mean, not right now, but y'all are like, y'all are gonna be accountable to some high crimes and misdemeanors.
Absolute high crimes and misdemeanors.
That's what Malcolm Nance always says.
I love that. So it was met with, so this, like, being thrown in the back of a paddy wagon was met with applause at the rally. And a few of the uniformed officers in attendance seemed to chuckle along with Trump.
I think that's the part that disturbed me the most.
Yes, absolutely.
There is a pretty overt, not only agreement in what he's saying, but laughter.
Yes.
Like, this is funny.
Right.
And you're supposed to be protecting neighborhoods and communities.
Right. And you think this is funny.
And you think this is funny. But the Suffolk County Police Department in Long Island did respond by tweeting, quote, the Suffolk County Police Department has strict rules and procedures relating to the handling of prisoners, and violation of those rules and procedures are treated extremely seriously. As a department, we do not and will not tolerate roughing up prisoners. I just have a hard time, like, fully believing that. Because, mm-hmm. A, we saw police officers laughing.
Right.
And B, we know about all this, you know, police violence.
Right. Absolutely.
That have, you know, disproportionately impacted communities of color.
Right.
And, you know, it's hard to sort of believe those words when actions say otherwise.
Well, right. I mean, you can say whatever you want, but, you know, your actions are so loud, I can't hear what you're saying.
Right.
Is basically what that comes down to. I mean, he was also criticized by other police departments, including, like, Houston and Gainesville, Florida. But the Association of Chiefs of Police actually put out a statement saying, quote, managing use of force is one of the most difficult challenges faced by law enforcement agencies. The ability of law enforcement officers to enforce the law, protect the public, and guard their own safety, the safety of innocent bystanders, and even those suspected or apprehended for criminal activity is very challenging. For these reasons, law enforcement agencies develop policies and procedures, as well as conduct extensive training to ensure that any use of force is carefully applied and objectively reasonable, considering the situation confronted by the officers.
Hmm.
Which sounds like a whole bunch of nothing burger.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like they're trying to thread the needle a little bit.
Right.
It's right. Like, in some cases, they might feel like excessive violence or sort of that kind of thing.
Force is necessary.
It's necessary. But, you know, as we've seen, a lot of that happens too often. And
right.
People get killed. And
exactly.
And it's, you know, people of color who are getting killed.
Right. And so that, I mean, yeah, like you said, they're trying to thread this needle a little bit while saying we don't condone the use of excessive force, but in some situations, force is necessary.
Right.
Which I understand. I mean, that's fine. But yeah, it doesn't sound like they're taking much of a stance either way.
Yeah. And the ACLU actually responded and said, quote, encouraging police to dole out extra pain at will is urging lawlessness that already imperils the lives of people of color at shameful rates. And, you know, this isn't the first time that Trump has utilized violent rhetoric. I mean, we've talked about this.
Right,
absolutely.
This is
nothing new. This is a total pattern. But there was one moment, one rally in particular in 2015 in Alabama, while on the campaign trail, where he encouraged violence against Hillary Clinton, Muslims, and then a black protester at the rally who was being punched by a white man there.
Yeah.
Or by white men there.
Yeah.
And so, it's just, this is part of a larger and more disturbing pattern.
Yeah.
And, you know, violence against communities of color have long been a problem, but now we have a president who is specifically sort of encouraging it. Mm-hmm. And that is really disturbing.
Yeah. And what's also really disturbing is that this rhetoric was kind of couched by the administration as pro-police and in tandem with Jeff Sessions' policy to, quote, review all existing agreements to ensure they do not work against the Trump administration's goals of fighting violent crime while protecting officer safety and morale. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Sessions' DOJ is looking to actually ease up on oversight on police brutality cases. And police unions seem to be happy about this. But local law enforcement is saying, like, no, we want to keep these rigorous standards to combat police brutality.
Yeah.
But the fact that local law enforcement has to say that because our federal government wants to ease up on oversight.
And then the fact the president is, like, overtly encouraging violence.
Right.
Well, I mean, you get to a certain point, you know, it happened with the Boy Scouts. The Boy Scout CEO eventually apologized. Why are you inviting the president to speak? Right. I mean, it's a sad state of affairs, but... Yeah. You know that he's going to say some shit.
Well, it's also hard.
You're going to have to end up apologizing.
I know. Well, it's really hard. I mean, at least in the Boy Scout, you know, at the Jamboree every year, the president is invited to speak. Mm-hmm. Just like the First Lady is offered an honorary position in the Girl Scouts. Like, it's just tradition. So I'm not saying that that's, like, a great thing, but I'm saying, like, yeah, maybe we have to start examining some of these traditions now.
Yeah. I mean, because what's the point of, you know, engaging in tradition when... The person in charge of our country is bucking every democratic norm.
Exactly.
Imaginable.
Exactly. So, you know, during this rally, Trump also said that he would try to pull federal funding for sanctuary cities, you know, which include, you know, New York City, San Francisco, Los Angeles. And then he also offered to personally pay for the legal fees for anyone that assaulted a protester at the event.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
That sort of echoed, didn't he do something similar on the campaign trail?
Yeah.
He was, like, encouraging violence against protesters and saying, like, he'd pay their legal fees, basically.
Mm-hmm.
This is the shit that makes me so angry.
Yeah.
And this is what we talked about last podcast, is, like, you know, people don't want to admit that this sort of blatant bigotry and open hatred is actually quite a compelling message to white Americans. And it doesn't have anything to do with economics.
No, at all. You know, at the very fucking least, this is disgusting.
Yeah.
Like, base level. But more than that, it's just, it's a direct and violent attack against people of color is what this really feels like. We know that the criminal justice system is set up in a way that targets communities of color. And by asking police to increase their violence in a time where police brutality is linked inextricably to killing people of color, it sends a not-so-coded message that violence against non-white populations is sanctioned by the federal government.
That is the most disturbing part
about this. That's the most disturbing part about this. And, you know, Trump, as much as we hate it here at Hellbent Headquarters, is the president. Mm-hmm. And as such, his words hold meaning to people here and around the world.
Yeah.
So his words, while not surprising here, are impactful. And we cannot, nor should we not, take these words as the incoherent ramblings of a racist man, but rather as policy that our country is trying to set forth.
It's kind of both, but
it's,
yeah.
It's both.
But ultimately, it's the second.
But I'm saying it is the first, but you can't just take it as that.
Yeah, you can't just say these are empty words.
Right.
They're not empty
words. It's not how this works. If he were still just the host of The Apprentice, then yes, they're empty words. They're just the ramblings of a racist dude.
And you could probably even make an argument that they're not just empty words because he has a big platform,
That's true.
But as president, he's in a uniquely powerful position.
Right.
And, you know, I'm more, like, annoyed and kind of angry with the people who are, like, surprised by all this in terms of, like, oh, wow, I guess we should start taking this shit seriously. And it's like, where the fuck have you been the last 2 years?
Right.
Like, come on.
His first day of his campaign, he called Mexicans rapists.
Yeah.
Like.
And he's long had a racist history,
yeah,
too. Like, even before he ran for president. But certainly on the first day of his campaign,
right,
he was openly stoking racism and bigotry. And it's like, you remember all the people, the pundits who told us that we should give Trump a chance?
Fuck those people.
Fuck those people.
Fuck those people.
Okay, Devin, I think it's some high time for gratitude checks.
Yes.
We could really use it.
I think we could.
Right now. So what are you grateful for today?
Okay, so first thing I'm grateful for is a really short story. Like, there's not a lot to this, but I just want to bring up. So Planned Parenthood is sending capes to all of the senators who voted no on the Trump care slash skinny repeal slash whatever the fuck Republicans are calling it. they tweeted, quote, thanks to all of the heroes who helped hashtag stop Trump care. We delivered I Stand With Planned Parenthood capes to all the senators who protected our care.
That's cute.
I love that.
Yeah.
You know, and I think I quoted on Twitter, I was like, not all heroes wear capes, but you know.
But sometimes, you,
but
get
sometimes
a cape.
You get a cape.
Sometimes you get a cape.
Yeah. So
also, Planned Parenthood was a big part of like organizing like protests yes. against healthcare. Like they're part of like sort of more broadly women really right. stepping up to the plate. So
yes,
good job, Planned Parenthood.
Right. So the second thing I'm grateful for is Austin Mayor Steve Adler. He offered positions on the city's police force to transgender service members affected by Trump's ban.
Which has not gone into effect.
Right, which
yet.
Is not
we
a thing.
We don't even know if it what's going to happen with right. it because he tweets first, doesn't and, think of any policy later or right. how it's going to be implemented.
Right, but it, I thought it was a nice sentiment. So he tweeted, quote, if you're qualified to keep our country safe, you're qualified to keep Austin safe. Transgender Americans are welcome on our police force. And then Adler's communications director, Jason Stanford, said, quote, that's how we do things in Austin.
Nice.
And it was just like a nice moment. Again, no ban is in effect. We're in very like a limbo, liminal state here. But just the fact that there are people who are already like, look, standing up and saying this
supporting
is
the, support, right. supporting the trans community. Although it still is treating a symptom rather than like a root cause.
Absolutely.
Right? Like
absolutely.
Trump saying that he's going to do this has larger implications for sort of LGBT rights.
100%.
Like, you know, throughout the country and
oh yeah
in
I mean
it's, days months years to come
oh it's a huge problem
yeah
I just thought this was a nice
gesture.
Isolated gesture
yeah
sometimes you gotta take the small things especially in this administration also side note Austin's interim police chief Brian Manley which is such a great name he actually appeared at the state capitol to speak out against SB3 which prohibits transgender people from using the bathroom that corresponds to their gender identity
mm-hmm.
So SB3 was passed by the Texas Senate but is waiting on a vote in the House and then the governor's signature so you know apparently Austin is just as awesome as we like it to be and then last I've got one more quick one Nancy Pelosi I'm always grateful for Nancy Pelosi but there was a great video of her basically dragging Trump and she was wearing a like a rainbow wristband while
nice.
She did it and she was just talking about his like methods of like bullying people.
Yeah, she was like, I talked to New York people who know him.
Yeah.
Here are the four steps.
Yeah.
Here's what he does.
Here's what he does. He, one, charm. Two, bully. Three, abandon. Four, sue.
Yeah, so basically he goes through those steps.
Right.
And when he doesn't get the outcome he wants, he then sues.
Right.
And so she was kind of talking about it as it relates to Comey, because apparently he's trying to sue
Comey
now.
Mm-hmm. So basically he tries to charm you. If that doesn't work, he bullies you. If that doesn't work, he abandons you.
He fires
you.
FBI director.
And if that doesn't work, then he sues you.
Yeah.
So she basically calls Trump a bully and says that he needs some discipline.
Yeah.
And she says that nobody in the White House has the courage to discipline him. Which I thought was great. And she also says, quote, he needs some work and he needs some sleep.
At the very least.
Which is, like, brutal as fuck, and I love it.
Yeah. And, like, she just, I love, she had a great quote recently, too, where she said, I'm a master legislator.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, you own that shit.
Right.
Own it.
And people were like, oh, you know, they were basically upset that she said it. It's like, well, she is.
Yeah.
So, I don't like.
People are upset when women, like own their excellence.
Yeah.
I say, you know, don't just reclaim your time.
Reclaim your excellence.
That's all I'm saying. You know, trademark Maxine Waters.
Right. Okay, Sarah. So what are you grateful for?
Okay, so the first thing I'm grateful for is a federal judge in Arkansas. So it's U.S. District Court Judge Christine Baker. She blocked Arkansas from enforcing several extreme abortion restrictions that reproductive rights advocates say would have had a devastating effect on patients. And actually, the ACLU and the Center for Reproductive Rights sued Arkansas on behalf of an abortion provider in the state to block these measures. So shout out to the ACLU and the Center for Reproductive Rights as well. So this preliminary injunction, which happened on Friday, ensures that four new laws will not go into effect on Tuesday. So that's tomorrow. We're recording on a Monday, including a controversial law that could require patients to get permission from their sexual partners or family members before proceeding with an abortion.
We talked about that on the show before.
Yeah, we talked about this story. And that was a story we covered recently that basically meant that even Arkansas women who were sexually assaulted would have to
right.
run an abortion by the rapist. And
right.
so everyone was like, this is
no.
some dark shit. Like, fuck.
Darkest timeline.
This is dark. And I love what Baker wrote in the ruling. She said, quote, "The court is not convinced that importing the complex requirements for authorization advances a public health goal. These requirements also do not advance interests in women's health because delay and other negative effects would threaten women's health and well-being." So she was basically like, I'm calling some bullshit on this.
Yeah.
This is some bullshit.
This is some bull-ass shit right here.
And so this is good news, but, you know, as we know, abortion rights face an assault at the state level, like, sort of all across the country. According to Think Progress, which drew numbers from a think tank, during the first 6 months of this year, 28 states introduced legislation to impose some type of a ban on abortion, while 6 states have tried to outlaw the procedure entirely.
I'm speechless.
But again, now there are Democratic leaders who are saying, you know, reproductive justice is not a litmus test.
Right.
So these all things sort of tie together.
They really do.
They're not happening in vacuums.
6 states, that's a lot of states to try to outlaw abortion, which again is not how this works because there's a Supreme Court ruling. You just can't do that.
Which is now sort of tenuous.
Right.
Because Gorsuch is on the court and then Kennedy might retire.
Yep.
And so, yep, elections have consequences. I'm just going to keep saying that. They have... fucking consequences.
Oh, God.
The second thing I'm grateful for is Sally motherfucking Yates.
She's, oh.
I know.
So good.
The, you know, lest we forget, the queen of the constitutional clapback, which
yes.
is trademarked by R. Eric Thomas, one of our faves, a writer for Elle. So she's back with another op-ed, this time in the New York Times. So that's like what she does these days. She just like tweets things and gets like 100,000 retweets and then like writes op-eds for like the Washington Post and the New York Times. She's just like living her best life.
Yeah, right.
So the title of it is, quote, "Protect the Justice Department from President Trump." And she's really not fucking around here.
No, that title, like... like, that is to the point.
Yes.
Like, there is no dancing around the point here.
No. So she's sort of, like, reflecting on this, like, Trump Sessions drama, and she says, quote, "The president is attempting to dismantle the rule of law, destroy the time-honored independence of the Justice Department, and undermine the career men and women who are devoted to seeking justice day in and day out, regardless of which political party is in power. If we are not careful, when we wake up from the Trump presidency, our justice system may be broken beyond recognition," which is not dramatic.
It's not.
That's something we should all be very worried about.
I mean, she's talking about the Justice Department, but think about what Mitch McConnell has done to the Senate.
Yeah, well, and this is another thing, which is a whole other topic. But, like, in a lot of ways, Trump is just the logical extreme of the modern day Republican Party.
Right.
I mean, they're not so different after
all, right?
But Yates takes issue, especially with any president trying to bully an attorney general, regardless of how much of a dickwad he is.
Right.
Just that position in general, you know, like, Trump is basically mad that Sessions isn't protecting him from the Russia investigation. Trump is also wants him to sort of go after political rivals. Apparently, he wants Sessions to keep investigating Clinton and Comey, even though that investigation has already, like, been solved or,
and,
like, been closed.
Both Clinton and Comey are now private citizens.
Yeah. They're, like... There, this is nothing, like, focus on your own shit, man.
Yeah, right.
And then, you know, she also brings up how he fired Comey after Comey wouldn't back off from Russia or protect Flynn. So there's all these, like, ways that Trump has just subverted the process. And this line is particularly incisive. She said, quote, "He's ripping the blindfold off Lady Justice and attempting to turn the department into a sword to seek vengeance against his perceived enemies and a shield to protect himself and his allies." Like, say this, Sally.
Oof.
Say this.
I fan myself.
I know. Her underlying point is that the independence of the DOJ, when it comes to investigations and prosecutions, no matter how mundane, and especially, you know, how big this one is with Russia and Trump, that's paramount to the proper functioning of our democracy. And this is, like she has said, this is understood across party lines, but it obviously isn't with Trump. And we have a Republican Party that is enabling him, right?
Right.
So she ends the op-ed with, quote, "We must do more than rubberneck as we drive past this car crash." She's not pulling any punches.
No.
She says, quote, we all have a responsibility to protect our Justice Department's ability to do its job free from interference. The very foundation of our justice system, the rule of law, depends on it."
Oh, man.
Yeah, so it's a great op-ed. I would say everyone should read it. Also, side note, if any hellion has, like, the Sally Yates connects, let us know, because we'd love to interview her on the show. You can tweet us at HellbentPod or email us at hellbentpodcastla@gmail.com.
Yes, please do. I would love to talk to her.
Yeah. And then finally, we have one listener gratitude check, and it's a long one.
Right.
And we really love it. So we're going to read that one right now. Yes.
Okay. So this is from May via the Facebook group. She said, quote, I live in one of the reddest counties in Texas, Montgomery County, just 30 miles north of Houston, represented by Kevin Brady, whose few Democratic residents find each other and vent once a month via meetup. It can be a disheartening political atmosphere. But today I spent the full day in a volunteer training and orientation with the Montgomery County Women's Center, which offers a wide-ranging and comprehensive service to victims of domestic violence and sexual assault, and to men as well, despite the name. They are incredible and staffed by so many dedicated, compassionate, and giving people. Their services include a 24/7 hotline, safe space in an undisclosed shelter for up to 30 days where victims, and often their children, fleeing imminent danger are provided board, food, clothes, counseling, resources, non-residential individual and group counseling, advocacy and medical accompaniment as needed, legal counsel with their own team of lawyers and a relationship with the local DA, a transitional housing program where fully furnished apartments are provided at low cost with free life skill classes, including financial counseling, cooking, interview prep, arts and crafts, etc., and education and outreach to local schools on recognizing domestic violence and bullying, even in teen relationships, in families, and more. Wow.
Yeah. And then she says their mission includes crisis intervention and assistance, but they highlighted the importance of empowering with information, advocacy, and social change. They specifically mentioned accepting people from any religion, any sexuality, as well as transgender folks. It's clear they're here to help, not judge. And honestly, I was so grateful to even have a chance to learn about the amazing work they do and to be able to contribute. Even in Texas, which often only makes the news with things that make me rage, there are incredible people doing the work that needs to be done. We can make such a difference on a local and personal scale as much as the larger political one. And we're also a pretty white county demographically, but the group of volunteers, all women, were diverse in race as well as age and experience. We had people who could speak Spanish, Urdu, Gujarati, and Mandarin. Look at these amazing women doing the work.
Yeah.
I love this because for a lot of reasons. It's, you know, someone who's in a very red area, you know, who is teaming up with a bunch of women from a diverse set of backgrounds and doing the quiet, essential work that helps their local communities.
Absolutely.
And I think this is like such a great story, and I love this so much. So thank you to May for sharing it with us, and thank you for allowing us to share it with our listeners.
Yes. Okay, Sarah, so it is Monday, so we got to kick off the week with the Donald Trump dishonor in Dick Watery. We have one honorable mention and one winner.
Dishonorable mention.
Dishonorable mention.
And loser.
Good catch.
Yes. So our dishonorable mention is a national correspondent for Slate. His name is Will Salatin. And what he tweeted this weekend is absolute textbook irony, hypocrisy, and rape culture. Like, you could not script this any more perfectly.
Right.
So first, for some background, Queen Maxine was at it again with perhaps her most iconic moment to date, which we will definitely delve into more deeply on Thursday's show.
Yes.
You know, we have our Maxine Waters update and award, so we will get into that.
Yes.
But just quick context. So at a House Financial Services Committee hearing, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin was being a total dickwad and like wouldn't answer her questions. Mm-hmm. Like, he basically tried to run out the clock with bullshit, and she was like having none of it. And she used a method to, quote, reclaim my time, which apparently means that she can get dickwads to shut the fuck up so she can just have the floor again. Like, it's kind of genius.
It's true.
And it's like a whole rallying cry now. Like, reclaiming my time is everything.
Yeah. Well, and the way she did it was so, like,
was perfect.
It was, like, dry and just, like, no emotion. Just reclaiming my time.
Well, she was, like,
she was banging. End,
she was, like, I'm reclaiming my time. We'll get into it. You It'll honestly should just watch the video because we can't do it justice.
Right.
So that's all to give some context into what Will Salatin tweeted. So he took this moment and he quote tweeted someone talking about it. And he said, quote, advice to parents, teach your daughter to say no firmly and mean it. Men sense women's willingness to yield. Make clear you mean business.
Okay.
Devin. Okay. I know whenever you say okay.
Okay.
I'm like, she's ready to say some shit.
Well, I mean, look, we have a very lovely outline of like things we want to talk about in regard to this, but that is some bull fucking shit.
Oh, yeah.
Right there.
I mean, like, Can we talk about how, first of all, men, quote unquote, men sense women's willingness to yield, like how that might be one of the creepiest sentences like written of all time.
Right.
That like, that made my like skin crawl.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really disgusting. Also, teaching your daughter to say no, which you should. I mean, you should teach your kids to say no,
yeah.
Period. But, you know, it's putting the onus on them to say no.
And that's the problem, right? Like, and that's why it feeds into rape culture, is because really what we should be doing is teaching, you know, boys and men to not accept anything less than a yes.
Exactly.
To not proceed if they don't have consent.
Right,
exactly. For anything.
Right.
And, you know, the ironic thing, so here's where the irony comes in. So a bunch of women came to his mentions to tell him that his, you know, that this language feeds into rape culture, and then he quadrupled down and decried outrage Twitter and identity politics, which is just so fucking cliche.
So to
like,
sum
this
up.
Is like the textbook, like, man feels attacked, goes on the defensive, and says it's actually everyone else's fault.
Seriously. I mean, so to sum up just really fast.
This is where the irony actually comes in.
Really comes in. So a dude tells women and girls to, you know, learn to say no.
Tell men no.
And then a bunch of women come out and told him no. He freaked the fuck out.
Which is like totally case in point.
Yeah. So the only time he conceded his point was when a man told him that he was in the wrong. Which is just like double fuck you.
It's double fucking case in point.
Yeah.
Because it's like, we know that men don't listen to us.
Right.
And I had a whole thread about it. I won't go into it. But essentially, you know, women have to balance pushing back against men and staying safe.
Right.
You know, I sort of describe it as like a program, like running in mm-hmm. our brains.
Yeah.
It's always in the background. You're kind of calculating these risks in real time without even really fully consciously realizing it.
Right.
Like, it's always there. And, you know, there's a lot of intersections there. Like, black women are more likely to be, you know, fatally shot
mm-hmm.
by intimate partners than white women.
Right.
The CDC found recently that overall, like, intimate partners are the ones who are killing women the most.
Right.
Trans women, of course, are, you know, uniquely vulnerable to violence, especially mm-hmm. trans women of color. So there's lots of intersections there. So it's not just about telling women to say no. It's about telling men to listen to us and respect us and not fucking hurt us.
Exactly.
And so that sort of language is really harmful.
Exactly. And then when it came time to actually listen to and respect women, he couldn't do it.
Yeah. So we're like, see, we told you.
Yeah.
Men don't listen to us.
Exactly.
Like, case in fucking point.
Right.
And you only listen to the man.
Like, yeah. Double, triple, you know what? Just quadruple fuck you.
Quadruple fuck you. So there were a lot of, like, smart women sharing their perspectives and experiences, but I really like what my friend Caitlin tweeted. She said, quote, "Men who believe they are above being challenged or critiqued because they generally support women's rights are always terrible allies."
Yeah.
And that, I feel like, speaks to so much of my frustration with a lot of men on the left
mm-hmm.
or a certain segment of men on the left, because it's definitely an attitude I've seen firsthand. You know, like the men who love to sort of fight for hypothetical women, but
right.
hate actually being challenged by real ones.
Right, right, right.
Like, they like strong women in theory, but not in practice.
Exactly. I was just going to say, I mean, I feel like everyone loves the strong, independent woman until you have a strong, independent woman telling you that you're wrong.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, bets are off.
Yeah, all bets are off.
And it's very frustrating.
This is what this guy proved.
Yeah.
And what women were like, yeah, I mean, just your reaction shows how hard it is for women and how men really don't respect us.
Exactly.
Especially men who think they do.
Exactly. So
that's our dishonorable mention.
What a dickwad.
Dickwad. Our sort of loser. The Donald Trump dishonor and dickwadery. This story is really upsetting, and it might be triggering for some people. The content of the story has to do with hate crime, so if you don't want to listen, we're going to give you a moment to sort of skip ahead until we get into it.
All right.
Okay, so Lil Duval is a stand-up comic, and he appeared on The Breakfast Club and said that he would, quote, kill a trans woman if he discovered he had sex with her. Like, he was trying to sort of, quote, unquote, joke about it.
Okay.
He also misgendered Janet Mock, because at the root of this sort of trans misogyny is the false belief that trans women aren't really women, and therefore the men who are intimate with them are gay, which also adds a deeply homophobic element as well.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of really complex issues at play here that are harmful.
Right.
And that, you know, play into trans women being killed.
Right. We're really hitting the dickwad triad here.
We really are.
So Laverne Cox responded to the interview and said, quote, "Some folks think it's okay to joke about wanting to kill us. We have free speech, but that speech has consequences, and trans folks are experiencing the negative consequences with our lives. It hurts my spirit because this isn't funny. Our lives matter. Trans murder isn't a joke." So this is sort of what we were just talking about, yeah, too, how it all plays into that risk calculation, mm-hmm, that, you know, with all these different intersections. So speaking out and standing up for yourself is important. But then, as Laverne Cox said, like, there are negative consequences to our lives.
Yeah. And just existing.
Just existing.
It's not even for trans women, especially. It's not even just,
say, like,
pushing back against, right, men or not. It's literally just existing. Yeah. They are vulnerable. And, you know, trans people, like we mentioned, are especially vulnerable to violence. The Human Rights Campaign recorded 22 violent deaths of trans men and women last year. And so far in 2017, the HRC has recorded 15 violent deaths of mostly trans women of color. And that's just within the first 7 months.
Right. So you might have heard the term panic defense. According to the LGBT Bar Association, quote, "Gay and trans panic defense tactics ask a jury to find that a victim's sexual orientation or gender identity is to blame for the defendant's excessively violent reaction."
Yeah.
"The perpetrator claims that the victim's sexual orientation or gender identity not only explains but excuses their loss of self-control and subsequent assault of an LGBT individual. By fully or partially acquitting the perpetrators of crimes against LGBT victims, these defenses imply that LGBT lives are worth less than others." And only California and Illinois currently outlaw this defense tactic, although the American Bar Association called for its abolition in 2013.
Yeah, so there's 48 states that still
allow it.
And, you know, Illinois, I remember seeing a story that they had passed it in their state legislature and they were just waiting for the governor's signature, which they expected, but I couldn't find confirmation.
Right.
So we'd have to dig a little deeper in Illinois because that just happened.
Right.
I thought Rodimus Prime also had a really good thread on this because there's a lot of issues at play here. He said, quote, "The worst part about that conversation on the Breakfast Club, this is exactly what Trump intended with his military ban on transgender folks. The conversation started with them asking Duvall about the military ban and ends up with them laughing at trans panic murder. These bans and bathroom bills are all about ostracizing trans folks from society and emboldening bigotry towards them. And on a show where I'm sure they'd claim to disagree with much of what Trump says, they are in lockstep with this administration. And that's what this shit is. And that's why all this shit is related. Not wanting trans folks to be discriminated against in the military isn't about quote unquote patriotism to me. I just know folks need to be defended at every turn because the attack is unrelenting and without mercy. But anyways, that's how this shit works with these federal decrees against marginalized people. Shit divides and they conquer. People think, quote, what do I care if 16,000 transgender people can't be in the imperialist military? The point is to make you not care at all. And like Devin mentioned, this stuff is related to sort of what Will Salatin said on Twitter and how it's sort of incumbent upon women to change their behavior, mm-hmm, in order to change men's behavior. And it's really not, you know, it's on men to respect women.
Right. And to change their behavior.
And to change their behavior. You know, and like we've said, women have always had to balance, you know, not only being who they are, but just how they interact with men, when they choose to push back, when they don't. And we have to balance that with staying safe. And if you're a woman who belongs to multiple marginalized groups, i.e. if you're a trans woman of color, for example, then you are uniquely vulnerable to men's violence. And worst of all, you know, our institutions still largely protect the men who perpetuate this violence. I mean,
right,
we just talked about how only two states at most have outlawed this.
Right, the panic defense.
The panic defense.
Yeah, so it, you know what? This shit cannot be taken lightly, and it is certainly not fucking funny. Okay, Sarah, so last but not least, let's talk about some action items, so things that our listeners can do after the show to get involved.
Yeah, so the first thing we wanted to flag for folks, especially on the heels of this last story, is the hashtag #TransFolksAreNotJokes. It was started in response to the story we just shared about Lil Duval quote-unquote joking about killing trans women. So please tweet and or retweet to show solidarity and support to the trans community. And I would also add to go to ourstates.org. and call your state reps, especially if you don't live in Illinois and California, where mm-hmm. legislation has been passed. Call them and ask them what they're doing
right.
about this issue, because it's, you know, like we said, its systems are really set up still to protect perpetrators
right.
and not victims of violence.
Absolutely. So, I mean, you can specifically ask about getting rid of the panic defense or, you know, other...
A whole host of issues.
A whole host of issues, you know, ask them what they're doing. So the second sort of social media campaign we want to talk about is hashtag No Confederate. So the creator of the hashtag OscarSoWhite at Reign of April is rallying against the show Confederate. A little bit of background.
Yeah, we've talked about this on the show before.
Yeah, but I'll give you some quick background. The creators and slash showrunners of Game of Thrones, D.B. Weiss and David Benioff, are working on a new show called Confederate that imagines modern-day slavery and what the U.S. would look like if the South had won the Civil War. So, seriously, this
yeah.
is a serious thing. So, kind of as a side, like, the side goal or side note is I've had some pushback that this is sort of thought policing and that we should let pop culture be pop culture, to which I say no.
Yeah.
Fuck you. Pop culture is extremely influential in our society, and which projects and shows get produced is very telling.
Yeah, it's a very reciprocal thing, right?
Yes.
Because... It sort of reveals larger power structures
yes.
and power imbalances, but also it can help influence culture and move the needle toward the right sort of side of history.
Exactly. I mean, we really do not need two white dudes painting a picture of modern day slavery. To be fair, there are also two black showrunners on this show. And so there is sort of, you know, some discussion about like...
how they're going to approach the show.
Right.
But, you know, a lot of people, I think... just feel like the content of the show, no matter who, you know, what's
right.
who's doing it, is pretty offensive.
Well, and even if you think this is a quote unquote cool idea, please try to read the room a little bit here.
Mm-hmm.
So we are in a moment where police violence against communities of color is rampant, and where the fucking presidents of the fucking United States just made a speech telling police that they should be more violent.
Yeah.
If there was ever a time for a show about modern day slavery, this is not fucking it.
Yeah.
So I personally do not think it is ever the right time, but definitely not right now, assholes.
Yeah, and I think too, it's just, you know, there's so much still that we're contending with as a country
mm-hmm.
with the Civil War and what happened after it. I mean, there are Confederate monuments that are being taken down right now, and people are still up in arms over it.
Right.
There's still Confederate monuments that still stand.
Right.
Like, there's a lot I think our country hasn't wrestled with, and
right.
there's a lot of lore, like we talked about, and I don't think people really know
right.
what truly happened
yeah.
before and during the Civil War, and there's still a lot of education to do about the effects of slavery still to this day.
Right, without reimagining modern-day slavery.
Right.
So the campaign's goal is to get the Confederate project canceled, and it launched the hashtag last night during Game of Thrones, where it was the number one U.S. trend and the number two worldwide one, which
yeah,
is
amazing.
Amazing. So then April, who created the hashtag, appeared on CBS This Morning explaining her immediate resistance. She said, quote, "There are times when things are so egregious that you don't need to wait for them to come to fruition before you object to them. Our goal is to have the show Confederate not see the light of day. That's the bottom line." So you can keep tweeting and retweeting with the hashtag hashtag no Confederate to support this campaign.
Yeah, and I don't know what the next steps are. I'm assuming they might want to do it again
yes.
Next Sunday night. But follow that hashtag and you'll be up to date with the latest on it. But
right.
it's definitely a worthy social media campaign to get behind.
Absolutely.
And today is also Black Women's Equal Pay Day. So lend your voice to the hashtag Black Women's Equal Pay. So this sort of commemorates the day when Black women's pay finally catches up to what white men made in 2016. And the ACLU actually had a really interesting infographic. So Black women would need to work more than 66 years to earn what a white man earns in 40 years. So equal pay is definitely, it's a gendered issue, but it's a racial issue as well.
Absolutely.
So lend your voice to hashtag Black women's equal pay. And then we also... A fellow Hellion reached out to us. His name is Dylan, because his friend, who's also a Hellion, was recently diagnosed with leukemia, and he could really use your help. So they actually reached their initial goal of $60,000, which would pay for a medical transfer to California that insurance didn't cover. but they're continuing to fundraise to defer the financial burden of 3 years minimum of treatments and unexpected medical expenses. Mm-hmm. So, Mayor, if you're listening, we're behind you 100%, and we're sending you lots of healing thoughts. Yes. And thank you to Dylan for reaching out to us about this. So you can go to GoFundMe.com/mayors, that's MEIRS-medical-fight. Again, I think this really goes to show that, you know, there's a lot of progress still to be made with our healthcare system.
Absolutely.
We sort of talked about, you know, wanting to get to universal health coverage eventually, but, you know, single payer is not the only avenue, and there's lots of roadblocks in between where we are now and where we want to be. But yeah, it really goes to show you that there's still lots of problems to be solved with our healthcare system. And then finally, we just want to remind folks, speaking of healthcare, the fight is not over. We talked about it. You know, Republicans might be trying to reconfigure a plan. I mean, as long as they have all three branches of government, I don't think we can ever feel really safe.
Right.
So, you know, like we also talked about, Trump is threatening the ACA directly by withholding subsidies and taking direct action to collapse insurance markets. Not to mention that disinformation campaign that we were talking about.
Yes.
In a recent podcast.
He's literally on government website with government money, has been like talking about how bad ACA is.
This is on the Health and Human Services
website.
Like, and like Tom Price, and they're like making videos and like social media campaign pushes. So
And the administration is trying to cut the amount of time people have to enroll in the healthcare markets.
Right, right.
Which will also
cut it in half.
Yeah, which will also impact enrollment and then, you know,
how it works,
because this really depends on people enrolling.
Right.
So
keep calling your senators and reps and urging them to fight against Trump and his campaign against the ACA. You know, while this latest repeal failed, we still need to stay, I think, aware of other ways the administration can undermine healthcare for Americans.
Yeah.
And like, there really is a lot on the line here. So just don't sleep on this issue.
Right.
I would say.
Yeah.
I feel like we always have to do like a deep yoga breath after these shows, because there's so much.
There's so much. We really packed a lot in. And yeah, we have a really exciting guest coming up this week. And we are excited to see you again on Thursday. For more information on today's episode, please visit our website at www.hellbentpodcast.com. You'll find the articles we discussed as well as additional resources. You can follow us on Twitter at HellbentPod, and you can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/HellbentPodcast. You can follow Devin on Twitter at DevinHandy, and you can follow Sarah on Twitter at SarahLerner.
Please listen on iTunes and rate us 5 stars, because that's just like the rules of feminism. We also have a Patreon, and you can find us at patreon.com/HellbentPodcast. You can support us for as little as $1 a month, and for $5 a month, you get access to exclusive content, mini podcasts, and behind-the-scenes looks at the making of Hellbent. And there are lots of other fun rewards for higher levels of patronage, including a monthly Skype session with Devin and Sarah.
And for that one, drinking is optional.
Optional.
Quote unquote.